You either make your comment or ask your question. There's a mic in the middle of the room, so I'll open the floor now to anyone who wants to make a comment. Yes.
Hi. Nima Gomeshi, doing my master's at Carleton University in trade policy. My question is with respect to the link that was mentioned a couple of times in a couple of the presentations on today's environmental challenges and the financial reforms that we're looking at. And my economics may not be strong enough, but I'll throw out my current conceptualization, and if there's an error in it, then I'd appreciate you pointing it out. If there isn't, then perhaps we can discuss that. And that is, we've been talking about how to stabilize the economy and bring employment levels back, and there's this discussion about economic growth, but also within the whole environmental debate is certainly there's climate change and so on, but there's also questions of just consumption levels simply being unsustainable, and our society's consumption rate simply not being appropriate. And that goes in stark contradiction to economic growth as something that sustains our economic model. So I think prosperity can be taken in one of two ways, as I see it, either increased money, disposable income, or increased time off. Has there been any discussions, or is it viable to consider employment levels, voluntary unemployment levels, as a way, as part of the reforming of the economic system moving forward, and a way of addressing the environmental challenges? So, was that clear? If not, I can try my best to clarify.
Well, I think that your main question, as I understood it, is whether the environmental challenges that the world is going to be increasingly facing run counter to the growth that we all are talking about as the engine that's going to get us out of this recession and into a stable long-term economic trajectory. I'd invite anybody on the panel to talk about how they see this imperative of taking environmental action with the broader growth agenda. Do you have a follow-up point on that?
I think that's the broad question, and more specifically, what I'm wondering is voluntary higher unemployment levels a viable way of actually meeting the two? So instead of, lower 30 hours per week, for example, standard 30 hours per week, which means that lower economic growth, it's mean lower production, but also means lower consumption, which would address environmental issues.
Just a couple of points. I think you raised some valid issues, but I would distinguish the challenge for rich countries and poor countries. I think the question that you ask is really a rich country question. I would submit that, you know, for poor countries, there's no option but to look to continued economic growth to improve living standards, employment levels, and so forth. I mean, two-thirds of the world live still at abysmally low standards of living. So one cannot but look to economic growth and distribution to meet their needs over the next century. Now, for rich countries, the situation is different. And in fact, there has been some interesting research by economists, including John Helliwell in this country from University of British Columbia, who've looked at the correlation between economic growth and fulfillment or happiness and so forth. This was an issue that used to be dismissed as a cavalier preoccupation, but has now actually gotten some fairly serious research attention. And these economists feel that there is a turning point as countries become richer, at which additional increments of income and wealth do not lead to personal satisfaction and fulfillment. So they do point in the direction that you're suggesting, that, you know, rich countries should indeed find ways of utilizing both time and the opportunities provided by their wealth and economic growth so as not to visit, you know, further depredations on the climate, on the planet's resources.
I was just going to add a couple of other thoughts to Roy's comment. I mean, if we're looking at where that new equilibrium will come, it seems to me the equilibrium that is more likely to be one which is humanly and as well as economically sustainable is to see the transformation coming from the introduction, both in the North and in the South, of new technologies which are more energy efficient, and then creating and opening up the space for something else, which is a little bit more complicated for people in the North, which is a process by which more resources are being transferred from the North, hopefully economic resources which they can utilize, to enable them, in a perverse way, to actually grow faster than we are, to grow, to remove this dilemma, the burden they have of poverty that they're also encountering. I mean, it's not so obvious that if all of us were in this room were sitting down, sort of, you know, not at work, but instead we're driving our cars around faster and faster and consuming energy, that a more leisurely society would actually be a less energy-intensive society, to me.
I just have one small comment to add to Roy's. I think very much the question you pose is a question more pertinent to the rich countries than the poor countries. But when we talk about the rich countries, the other thing we need to be thinking about, and it has enormous potential financial implications, is the rapid aging of rich countries as well. So this idea of people voluntarily removing their labor from the economy, which is, I think, what you were getting at, is probably exactly what cannot happen with larger and larger shares of our population becoming very old and the fiscal challenges of producing enough income to finance especially healthcare, but other services that are going to be required for very old populations. So this is a backdrop also for a lot of this stuff in the rich countries. Other comments, questions? Yes.
My name is Bill Ryan. I'm a Jesuit priest and economist. I'm at the Jesuit Forum in Toronto. I guess one of the questions comes to my mind is we're trying, both last night and today, we still seem to be technical solutions. And I think human solutions are going to become much more important. Nobody has mentioned ethics, for instance. But I think when we talk about ecology, particularly, I think it comes in a whole other dimension that more human. In other words, I think ecology and humanity are very closely related. So I'm wondering whether in all this discussion we have to find a new way of doing economics, as it were, like you can say, like it's, ecology can longer be outside the analysis. How do we bring that in? And how do we really begin to take seriously, well, in the past it's been ideology, but just new ideas and new values? Because I think we have the feeling as we go around that we've downplayed far too much the human dimension, the integral human development. And unless we go there, I don't know how we can ever live together. We have to find some way that we like each other. We'll talk to each other. We can't just look for a technical solution. I just wonder what comments you would make to that.
Anybody want to?
I'll march into the ethical minefield. Well, it may seem to you to be partly a technical response. So don't hit me yet, but. When I was talking, I was trying to allude to the fact that we need changing political values in our political framework to make these things happen. And it seems to me that the ethical input that you're talking about, and which I'd be very sympathetic to, is going to be mediated through the political processes that we're all part of, rather than through the narrow technical laws of economics. I mean, we heard the statement, and I remember talking to my son, who's one of those macroeconomists who does these equations, about how the great crisis that we've just gone through was created by mathematically obsessed individuals, as well as very greedy individuals. But those are the laws of economics that we're talking about, or the economic debates we're talking about, are then a very practical mechanical process, although they affect all our lives. It seems to me if you want to change that world, and you know, I mean, that's something we all have the option to do, it has to be mediated through the political process. It's not that you need protests outside the IMF because it's using the wrong economic equations, but you need protests in front of the IMF's board when they're discussing issues about how they would distribute resources or what conditions they will oppose because of the impact on people. And that is a political statement, it's not an economic statement. Although the economic practitioner will hopefully be brave and bold enough to turn those into mathematical equations to help you rationalize it. So the breakthrough on gender issues internationally was not because suddenly people recognized that women were important in society, even though that's a very obvious reality, but because we were able to persuade some of those macroeconomists that to ignore a third of the world's economic creativity was a very stupid economic decision. But it was not, it was the political statement which drove that change of attitudes. They quote, rationalized it.
Bill, I really strongly sympathize with your question. I think it's really at the heart of what brings people to this room today. And so we neglect that at our peril. What I was trying to say in my remarks is that we also neglect what the technicians are doing. And if we don't tackle them head on, then I don't think we will get at these human solutions. We need to confront the technicians. And this is complementary to what John has just said. And really have a debate as to, you know, what is the goal here? What are we aiming for? So I take comfort, as I was saying, by the fact that the Nobel Prize winner this year, or what, the co-winner, was not even an economist, but a political scientist. And it seems to me, since most of the people who are here bring with them some learning and knowledge and interest, to have a much more holistic view on issues of how we live together, you know, and not to see, you know, any one particular discipline or sub-discipline be triumphant over the rest of them, which is, I think, the situation that we face today. And finally, you know, Amartya Sen has long been moving in this direction. His latest book is precisely about ethics. And here is an economist who's been a very technical economist, who has also concluded, as you are concluding, that it's time to bring ethics into the heartland of the way we think about these issues.
Okay, next question over here.
Yes, thank you. My name is John Foster with the North-South Institute. I wanted to pick up on John Sinclair's point about proliferation and add as well the questions of legitimacy and accountability. It seems to me that the Stiglitz report proposal for a global economic council, which, as I've noted, is not necessarily all that new. People like Sonny Ramphal and former President Cedillo and Jacques Delors have all favored some sort of such arrangement within the UN system in recent years. And that, in fact, the Cedillo proposal provides not something extra, but actually bringing the G20 into a broader framework of accountability and legitimacy to the rest of the 170. And the suggestion of an electoral or representative or constituency system provides, I think, an answer to those who hide their privilege behind arguments around, well, only 20 people in a room can have a good discussion. Question is, who are those 20 people and how are they chosen? Is it Obama and friends? Or is it something with some global legitimacy? There is, I think, an attitude that is pretty, I've been watching the UN discussion in this matter for about 10 years, and I think there is at the moment an attitude in the Canadian bureaucracy which treats the UN with some derision. which is in contradiction to our supposed ambition to be a G20, to be a Security Council member, or to take leadership on the multilateral level. The issue of ethics was raised. Where in the last year was there a discussion which brought ethics and values into the discussion of the global economy? It was provoked by General Assembly President Descoto in the General Assembly, not in the G20. Where might you have the High Commissioner for Human Rights or whoever heads the new women's agency in the UN present in these discussions to balance the club largely of males? So I think there are a whole series of questions there. But my basic question heading toward Muskoka is, and for anyone on the panel, is where are the straws, I would say straws advisedly, which we can take into account in trying to build some form of Canadian leadership in this context? This is not a government that has prioritized multilateral agencies. So where are the elements of hope that you see that the people in this room can grab onto and work with? Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on and take a couple of other questions.
Okay, my name's John Dillon with Kairos, Canadian Ecumenical Justice Initiatives. And actually, my preoccupation is very similar to what John Foster just raised, but I want to pick up on a comment that John Sinclair made about membership of the G20 tends to be friends of the host of the day. And I think this is a very telling comment, because if you go back to the formation of the original G20 of finance ministers, my memory is that prior to its creation, there was a G18 in the wake of the Asian financial crisis. And this created some discomfort because Malaysia was a member of the G18. And it was using capital controls and very heterodox policies that made the neoliberal orthodoxy of the IMF look very, very bad. And so one of the ways of kind of getting rid of the G18 was to create a G20, where Indonesia, in effect, substituted for Malaysia. And then similarly, moving up to the first G20 leaders meeting in Washington, my memory is that President Sarkozy, at the time, on behalf of the European Union, made a trip to Camp David and met with President Bush. And on the table was a proposal to convene an emergency meeting at the United Nations in New York. And instead of doing that, President Bush decided to convene the G20 in Washington. So I think this issue of continuing to marginalize United Nations structures, to keep out of the club of those invited, those that may choose to pursue different policy initiatives, is a very serious one. And looking forward to what happens at Huntsville and Muskoka, I think it would be a wonderful statement if Canada were to pick up John Sinclair's idea and have at the table a representative of the poorest countries so their voice could also be heard.
Thank you very much. I'm Norman Cook, currently with a couple of Japanese universities, but I'm an old CETA retired guy like John Sinclair. I'd like to really raise the question about that really, Roy, came out of one of your comments toward the end, one of your questions, and that's about the role of SDRs in particular. And I'm sorry to be so technical, especially since there's been a drive to make this discussion a bit more value-based, but I think that your original point about how the civil society community must become more aware of some of these technical issues is critical. So I think we can get some balance in that discussion. Mm-hmm. But around the whole question of SDRs, I was really interested in where you were going with that. and where the panel would go with that in terms of looking at SDR guarantees as one of the tools that might bring some greater discipline to this new architecture, if you will, that we're proposing. And very precisely, how that relationship might affect some of the poorest countries. For example, where would the where would the SDR guarantees go in the event of default on very specific undertakings in the international arrangements? Okay, I'd like to leave it there.
Okay, on the G20 issues, I mean, I think we should rely on Canada's interest, maybe desperation is a better word, of remaining a member of the club. I think this has always been a factor. You know, we're so desperate to be in the club that we will do what we can to remain a member of, in good faith, in good standing. But at the same time, I think there's always been Canadian pride in adding value, in exercising leadership. So we're not necessarily always there to play the tune of the superpower or of the prevailing majority among the G7 or the G20, just simply to remain a member. And I would strongly endorse this idea of John Sinclair's, as John Dillon was picking it up, of ensuring that the poorest be represented in a meaningful way at the table, not in a token way. And how that's done is, I think, at least as important as doing it in itself. On the issue of SDRs, I do think that we've reached a turning point through the G20 with the decision of the G20 in April to allocate $250 billion worth of SDRs, you know, compared to the outstanding $34, $35 that existed before. So that's a sea change in the quantity. But those who believe that the SDR does represent the possibility of introducing the SDR as the world's fundamental reserve asset, also believe that the volume of emissions of SDRs has to be stepped up, you know, in the order. I think last night it was mentioned 150 to 300 million a year, whereas some people would go even farther and say it would be in the order of 400 or so. When I raised the issue at the panel of how the SDR can play a supportive role to currency stability, Jose Antonio Campo said that one idea that's actually been kicking around for about 30 years now is that of a substitution account. In other words, those like the Chinese who want to diversify their reserves out of dollars can do so through an IMF, a substitution account, whereby they could exchange their dollars for SDR and in that way circumvent the foreign exchange market and avoid putting further downward pressure on the U.S. dollar. So, I mean, I think that's the factor that really needs to be taken into account. On your specific issue of the SDR aid link, basically what would be needed there is a subsidy account in order to subsidize developing country recipients of SDRs who then use SDRs to basically buy what they need from the markets or from other countries. And there again, we're talking about a fairly modest allocation of resources, but it would have to come from rich countries to poor. So there are a number of mechanisms around the SDR which really need to have a lot more analytical and focused attention if it's going to go ahead. But I think we've made a good start, and I hope that people in civil society preparing for Muskoka next year give this the attention that it deserves, because I think it has a lot of potential.
Add a couple of points to Roy's comments. As was implicit in a lot of what I was saying, it seems to me that we can start to unblock the logjam that we're talking about in changing the value framework. We have to go back to the issue of ethics that's operating in this world, not in a sense by sort of piecemeal technical issues, but by changing the way the political dynamic works in these institutions. I mean, whether we're talking about the UN framework or we're talking about the G20 or even, God help us, going back to the G7, it's the values and the importance that people attach to that debate that is probably going to sort of change the way behavior is there. The technicians are quite capable of responding to whatever instructions they get. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not to suggest they're just minions or mechanical people, but we can create a framework. We can go back to the question on the environment. We can create ways of managing the world economy which is more environmentally sensitive. It's not an impossible technical challenge. It's a question of whether we really want it as individuals. So it seems to me we really need to go back to that question of how do we change the political framework, and that is where a Canada could make a contribution at Muskoka. I mean, maybe, and that's, we then have to deal with Roy's very legitimate concerns about our protectiveness out of our seat around the table. We could be proposing, as Canada, that we want to open up the nature of the G20's membership to a more open and a more inclusive framework. I mean, one of the problems is we got locked into this historical accident of this group of people. I mean, just to clarify what I was saying, it wasn't that each time all of the G20 changed. It's just the fringe actors got changed by each person. You know, Mr. Brown added, you know, his couple of friends. Berlusconi added a couple of friends to what happened in Italy, and then we had a couple of friends added in Pittsburgh. But they were not changing the whole membership. But to change even some sub-components of the membership to be more open is going to be an act of political will by those existing members, and that's going to be the big challenge.
There's a couple of suggestions I've received for the remaining time we have. One is we have not really had a discussion yet this morning about the governance of the international financial institutions. We've had a lot of discussion about some important issues, including how big the club should be, but there are very real questions about the governance of international financial institutions, which if I would invite people to make comments or raise questions if they would like. The second remark I wanted to make is that I'm aware that we have members of the diplomatic community here, and it would be very interesting for us to get the perspective of some other countries other than Canada in terms of how they look at all of the questions that are the topic of this panel. So, but the floor remains open. I just wanted to put those two markers on the floor. Okay. I was hoping that Jo Marie would stay on the line to answer some questions, and I think Fraser's going to try to resume contact. We're spilling over into the coffee break, but I think we should take the opportunity, given these remarks and the relevance for especially the IMF governance issues, for people to make some comments, raise any questions, and especially if they're directed towards Jo Marie, Fraser can see what he can do to get them to her. Anybody want to respond in general, but in particular also to Jo Marie's comments? She raised some challenges for the Canadian community to contribute more to necessary reforms to the fund.
My name is Lucia Dolcetti, and I'm here in my personal capacity. I did serve with the UN many years ago in Southern Africa and in Cambodia, and I have not been working on these issues, unfortunately, for many years. But what I tried to keep always abreast is what comes from these countries in relation to several issues, including this. And you invited our guests from the diplomatic community to say something. What I have heard recently from some members of the diplomatic community here in Canada is that, for example, we haven't heard anything about apparently an important meeting that took place among finance ministers in Venezuela recently, where I think President Chavez suggested that we circumvent the IFIs and have our own southern hemisphere equivalent IMF, so to speak. And the other issue that I hear often is the role of China, notably in Africa, to allow African countries to circumvent, again, the bank and IMF assistance programs, and notably conditionality. And we know how much China has poured into several African countries to help them address their challenges without having to deal with the West and the IFIs. Thank you.
Fraser? Is Jo Marie connected again or not? Okay, are you aware of it? Were you able to get them? Okay. One was the recent initiative coordinated by Chavez to hold a meeting in Venezuela to set up an alternative structure to the IFIs. And second of all, the role of China as a development agent, especially in Africa. Well, Fraser's communicating that to Jo Marie. Anyone on the panel have any reactions to either of these points?
Yeah, I think they're excellent points. Look, the IFIs are not going to go away anytime soon. And I think the challenge is not so much to circumvent them, but to make them as positive instruments for social and economic progress and equity. I mean, that's really the challenge. And I would say also that there is some potential in looking more broadly than simply at the Bretton Woods institutions, the global financial institutions. There was some pushback in Istanbul when President Bob Zelik was suggesting a capital increase for the World Bank, which may, of course, be justifiable in its own terms. But some of the commentary attending that discussion suggested that perhaps it was time to expand some of the regional development banks, you know, the African Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, because they play important roles at a regional level. And Jose Antonio Campo was talking about the importance of regional institutions in his remarks yesterday. So we should, when we think about IFIs, we should think about a plurality of organizations, not simply the big ones at the center, you know, the bank, the fund, and the WTO, but institutions that can actually play very important roles at the regional level. And it's in these regional institutions that developing countries actually have a much more significant voice and vote in the governance of those organizations. So that's just something I think we need to factor in on IFI governance and reform. And as to China's role, I mean, this is, again, an extremely pertinent question. I think what we really need to do is to think of the kind of fora that we need in which to bring China into the discussion. The principal forum for aid coordination right now is one that is a creature of the OECD in Paris, the Development Assistance Committee, and the Chinese don't have a lot of interest in joining that particular forum. There is, however, another forum the UN has created, the UN, what's it called?
Development Cooperation Forum.
The UN Development Cooperation Forum, which has just existed for about a year now. one can suggest and recommend that maybe this is the place where aid coordination and aid policy should be talked about in a much more universal setting rather than in the privileged donor-dominated setting of the OECD Development Assistance Committee.
We're just going to try to elicit some comment from
you. Thank you. I think that that the observation that the regional development banks are much more important from the perspective of the developing countries, I know from the perspective of the African governments, they indeed would like to have the research and technology units of the World Bank and the IMF that work on Africa, have them in Africa, run of, by, and for Africans, rather than having all the expertise sitting outside of their region and always telling them what to do. Whereas the Asian bank is well staffed and so on. I wonder about the concern about China and about aid. China can be in any place it wants to be. And I also think that foreign aid per se is not that, this is heresy, I know. I think that foreign aid per se is often anti-development because it is the agenda of the developing of the donor country. And it is outsiders who come in, do the work, bring the money, set the agenda, and basically the people don't have to hold their own government accountable. I think that just taxes, where citizens and corporations active in the developing countries are responsible for contributing to the government, and then the citizens feel they have a stake in their own government. I think this is much more healthy for the development of developing countries in and of themselves, so they aren't always beholden to outsiders. I think if, for the sake of development and for climate change, we begin to pay the full price for all products, including the full labor cost, the full cost to the environment, the full cost for non-renewable resources, we will begin and then pay the taxes that are due. This will begin to make a shift in the power. And we have to be prepared as wealthy countries to be able to step back and no longer be members of the G20, no longer be members of the G8. This is very, very difficult, as the small Europeans are demonstrating to us how difficult it is to step back from power. So I think China can be in anything it wants. And China's actions in Africa are not all that admirable. They bring in a lot of money, but they also charge interest. They bring their own people, their own equipment. Yes, they build a road. They do it very effectively, but they aren't training Africans. They aren't leaving the know-how and the technology. So these are difficult issues. I also think that while we want to go to the regional banks and so on, the IMF and World Bank are going to be there as global entities because the powerful countries want them to be that. Unless and until the G20, the 20 most wealthy, powerful countries on the planet, want something different, when they want something different, they'll get it. Right now, they want the World Bank and IMF to do it, and we better get those institutions whipped into shape. Thanks. Sorry for taking so long.
Okay, thank you very much. I think to try to keep us roughly on schedule, we'll take this last question and discussion around that, and then we'll break for coffee.
Okay, thanks. My name is Soren Ambrose. I'm with Action Aid International, based in Kenya. So I want to interject one comment on Africa's representation at the G20 and also follow up on one thing Joe Marie said. I want to take us back briefly to 2002, the last time that Canada hosted the G8 in Kananaskis. And it was at that summit that a lot was made of the fact that African heads of state were being invited for the first time to a G8 summit. Five of them were invited to that. And out of that came something called the New Economic Partnership for Africa's Development, or NEPAD, which is a development initiative that has really not made nearly the progress that was hoped for, at least by its initiators in 2002. I was at Kananaskis, or actually in Calgary, like most of civil society, didn't get close to the meetings, but there was a lot of objection from African NGOs, many of whom were represented in Calgary at that time, to those heads of state's invitation because they happened without any popular participation. So I think it's important the way that this is done. How do you invite in Africa? One of NEPAD's only appearances on the international scene lately has been through Melish Zenawi, who is the current chair of NEPAD, who was invited to the G20 meeting in London as the president of NEPAD. He was the sole non-South African representative there. A lot of concern about South Africa dominating these fora on behalf of Africa. And I think that the reason that he was invited, though I've never seen this explained, is that the head of the AU at the time, and still is Muammar Gaddafi, head of Libya. So it was a little more inviting to the leaders in London to have someone like Mellish there rather than Gaddafi. But I think we have to think about representativity. How do we invite Africa in a way that is a legitimate representation of African interests and not another selection of one or two powerful heads of state who happen to be well-liked by the members of the existing club? On the issues that Joe Marie brought up, I want to emphasize, particularly for civil society groups in the room, the importance of the double majority initiative in IMF voting. I think there's been a tremendous amount of discussion about how to change percentages of votes that individual countries have there. And we're finding that really it's the southern countries who are represented in the G20, Mexico, China, Brazil, India, who are getting the big swings of additional votes at the IMF. And there's a real question about whether that's going to change the way that the IMF makes decisions or the decisions that are made. I think that double majority voting, which means the existing voting system, which is often referred to as $1, one vote, and a one country, one vote system where the representative of, say, the Francophone African countries, who represents 23 countries, would have 23 votes, whereas the US would have one vote for that vote count. That kind of system is probably the only one that has a realistic chance of shaking things up on the IMF board and the kinds of decisions that are made. So I think it's important for civil society groups who are concerned with reform of the IMF to take a serious look at double majority. It has some rhetorical support from people like Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of the IMF. We need to push them a little bit further and make sure that what they're supporting rhetorically is what they're supporting when decisions are actually made about the shape of reform. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Soren. I think given the time, we'll shut down this panel now. I'm sorry we ran late, but obviously it was worth the extra time to get some ideas from Joe Marie. I want to, on behalf of the conference, thank the panelists for their contributions. Fraser has asked that everyone go get coffee or whatever you want now, but that everyone should try to be back here by 11:30 for the next session so that we don't fall too far behind schedule. Thanks again.